Hello, just a quick bit before this week's episode to let you know that we have a Patreon you can subscribe to if you like what we're doing here and you want more of it. You probably already knew that. We don't stop going on about it. What you didn't know is that you can currently get a little free trial, so you know exactly what you'd get as part of your subscription. You can head to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in the show notes to get your first 7 days free. All you need to do is pick which tier you'd like a free trial of. The Biggest Mates tier is the one that has all the extras in it. And then for 7 days, you are free to listen to any episode we've released in the last 6 months. You can cancel any time or just leave the subscription rolling if you like what you find. It's charged monthly. And during any month, as part of that Biggest Mates tier, you'll get ad-free episodes of this show every Monday. You'll get a brand new episode of our new Manic Street Preacher show every month. 2 episodes every month of the Ultimate Playlist, our themed playlist show, where we talk about all kinds of different music, different artists, different genres, different eras, and 1 or 2 bonus episodes every month, depending on the length of the month. That's 2 episodes every week. There's also other tiers to trial. One that is just the Manic Show and ad-free What Is Music episodes, and another that is just ad-free What Is Music episodes. But hey, if the first 7 days are free, why not try a bit of everything? Plus, all tiers include access to the exclusive subscriber-only Discord where we discuss the shows, the bands we've covered, various music topics, and loads of other stuff, including some games that the friendly community have devised themselves. So head on over to our Patreon page now to claim your free 7-day trial. Go to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in our show notes. See you there.
It's the 9th of January.
It's the 9th of January and my Christmas tree's still up.
When's that tree going down?
I don't know, in the next couple of weeks? Does it have
down
to...
Down by the 5th.
Well, sorry, hang
bad
on.
Bad luck.
Now, okay. So
yeah, bad luck,
sixth,
Adam.
Isn't it 6th?
Well, it's the 9th anyway, so it's Metamo. It's the 9th, so...
I knew this was going to come up. Genuinely, I thought... I looked at the tree today and I thought, Lucas is going to have a word. and so my questions to you are, why do you care, firstly?
I care about your bad luck.
Okay, and that's my second question, is do you believe in bad luck?
No. You've obviously like checked out of the Christmasness of it because it's not lit up.
That's an energy saving issue. And I haven't necessarily checked out the Christmas thing because for lunch today I had 6 mince pies. Speak on that.
As many as 6.
Wait, hang on. As you many... had lunch. Sorry, Adam, you had lunch.
Yeah, but I won't have dinner now.
Small little snake. We need to cover this on a later date, but I mean, we've learned a lot about Adam's meal habits over the Christmas holidays.
Incredible stuff.
They are.
Me and Lucas have not stopped thinking about it.
Honestly,
wait, did I just say that at the Christmas drinks?
Yeah.
I didn't do it on mic. What was the point?
what was the point in us having a conversation?
I
did say when we were out that we should have just like popped a phone out and just recorded the whole evening just in case.
Really should have done. Yeah.
Just in case we wanted to say something that was really good and we could just stick it out there as some content, you know?
Yeah, Christ. It's a waste. Anyway, hello and welcome to What Is Music, a music podcast about music. We're a podcast that focuses on discographies in their entirety, doing deep dives on one artist at a time. You join us for season 6, which is called Are We Enjoying This? A critical analysis of the history, cultural impact and music of REM. We're going through their entire career, album by album, track by track, asking questions like, does context matter when you're listening to music? Does knowing the history of an artist affect your appreciation of their output? And this season we are, of course, asking, are we enjoying this? To be clear, we're asking, are we enjoying this in regards to the band REM, not are we enjoying this in regards to this, the 6th season of our podcast, which is called Are We Enjoying This, and which you may or may not be enjoying. I'm Adam Scott Glasspool. I'm a big music nerd. I'm a big fan of REM. With me, as always, 2 of my closest friends. The first is someone who's not a huge music nerd, is maybe the least knowledgeable on music in general out of the 3 of us, and is just learning through this podcast how to apply critical thought onto why he likes or dislikes something, and whether or not that means it's good. It is, of course, Lucas Way.
Jesus. When's this coming out? Like, it's heavy Christmas, isn't it?
Dude.
According to the images in front of me, it's still Christmas. Yeah. This is still valid.
Hey, we also have someone who's betwixt those 2 places, and it's only bloody Steve Murphy.
Imagine being betwixt a Twix.
How are you guys? Are you all right?
Yeah,
feeling,
all good.
Feeling pretty Christmassy.
You're feeling pretty Christmassy, are you?
Yeah, Steve, feeling pretty Christmassy?
No.
Oh.
I loved taking my decorations down.
On this podcast, we're exploring the entire discography of REM, and in the last episode, we started exploring Document, their fifth studio album, and this week we're going to continue our dissection, our exploration, and our discussion on that album in order to try and figure out and answer the question, what is music? I don't know how far we got. I think we probably got 2, 3, maybe even 4 tracks in. Maybe we got all the way to talking about monkeys. Who knows? Either way, let's start it off with a bang. Because it's probably a snare. Let's start off with this song. Ooh, oh, no snare.
It's a cover.
Lovely.
It's another cover.
Fed
up of them.
Well, I'm not sure how I felt about it when I found that out, because I hated when I found out about Superman. It really upset me on the last one.
It did, didn't it? It went from your highlight to one that you don't care about.
Because I thought you'd have recognised it from Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, but you just didn't, did you?
Is it in that? Oh, Superman, not there Strange. Go. Right, God, got it.
Yeah,
I got it. I don't think I mind it this time. So
it fits the album.
It fits
better,
the album. It's short and fun, and it fits
like
the vibe. I'm short and fun.
Yeah,
6 foot, mate.
Yeah, no, you're not.
I'm not. I told you this doesn't matter.
Don't say Steve's 5'10" because then that makes me like 5'4" or something.
I'm not insecure about my height.
Height doesn't matter. Height doesn't matter.
Of course, it doesn't matter. Who cares?
It's all about waist size these days.
Oh, God.
Bigger the better.
Oh, lovely. We go back to like medieval times. I'm like a king. this was intended as a B-side, but they found that it fit the loose, chaotic vibe of the first half of the record. So they put it on there as emblematic of the sound that they were inspired by, because they were inspired by the way that it was originally played by post-punk band Wire, and REM had been covering it on the tour for Life's Rich Pageant. Do you want to hear the original?
Yeah, I heard it.
Go off King, which you are.
Your face is like a baby who's tasted broccoli for the first time.
So perfect.
That is not a flavour of music that is tuned to my tastes, is it?
So you can see what they've done. They've REM'd it. They've sped it up. They've added harmonies. They've made it a vocal melody rather than like kind of like a snarl. They've done what they've been doing for the last however long we've been listening to them. They've taken something that's very post-punk, something that's, you know, much more kind of avant-garde, and made it more acceptable by blending it with 60s pop. You can just see them doing that on Strange.
I enjoy the song. It's fun. Mm. It's definitely better than the original for me. But yeah, I just don't love them constantly putting covers in things. Mm. I don't love the idea of, especially in the middle of an album. It's not so weird. Almost weirdly, I think if you're going to do it, at least just stick it at the end and it kind of feels like an extra.
Right, okay.
Like Mannix did with that. Was it McCarthy, wasn't it? The McCarthy song.
McCarthy, they did it with John Lennon.
Yeah, John Lennon as well, yeah. Yeah, something about putting one in the middle of an album just feels a bit odd, because it's almost like it doesn't feel like, and even though this is coming from me, who doesn't like, isn't someone who deeply respects the medium of the album and listens to things on shuffle, I think it's weird to like, well, surely it just breaks your whole like vision of what you're trying to do through this album, because that song is just like stuck in there because it's not yours, is it? It's just like another thing. You just kind of banged it.
It does fit the album.
It's like when we all moaned about, much more egregious in a different way, but when we all moaned about Feeling Good by Muse, because it was like really great album, would have been just banging that in, just like bleh, just pop it in there out. And it just kind of
I would say that Feeling Good doesn't fit the vibe.
Yeah, I know, that's what I said. I said it's more egregious, but like I just think the idea of sticking a cover in the middle of an album is a bit, I don't know.
I mean, we're in the 80s, so we're not that far removed from the 70s, which isn't that far removed from the 60s, and in the 60s loads of albums were like all covers. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, the Beatles, half of their first album is covers, you know? So yeah. People very rarely in those days did albums that were all originals. I mean, Frank Sinatra, we've talked about him on our sister show, The Ultimate Playlist. Do subscribe now if you can. Never wrote a fucking song in his life.
Mad, isn't it? That's such a mental thought.
His albums were all covers, you know? And yet he is credited with inventing the concept album. You know? So it's not as sort of like cut and dry as that.
But that's because he wrote The Wall, isn't it?
Yeah, he did, yeah. He wrote Pink Floyd's The Wall.
He was the whoa.
He was just
the
was the ghostwriter, wasn't he?
I like it. I think it shows their willingness to just be a fun, energetic party covers band, but it's all a bit scuzzier and darker, and it plays into the chaos. And I mean, this fits because the lyrics seem to depict chaos, strange things going on, bright lights, confusion. The original version is Joey's nervous and the lights are bright, so Stipe like inserts himself into the song, which I quite like.
I guess I'd just say just write your own scuzzy, dirty grunge song, you know?
Yeah, fair.
Yeah, but I mean, they've been touring with it and they've made it their own very much. Like, I got past the covers thing fairly quickly because I think this is really great. I remember like when it first sort of came on, I was like, I didn't know it was a cover, and I was like, I don't like this. The whole, there's something going on. There's something strange going on tonight. There's something going on that's not quite right. I was like, that's crap. That's just rubbish.
That's not very REM.
It's not very REM.
Yeah.
And then, guys.
Oh, and is then, it the harmonies?
And then where it goes to the bit where,
what is this? What is this voice?
There's something going on that wasn't here before, and that is when Michael Stipe just steps way back, and Mike Mills, I assume it's Mike Mills doing the harmony here, is doing that harmony that it is still the harmony, but it's completely taken over Michael's melody.
But I like that bit. Yeah.
I don't know what I've created the harmony goblin.
All right, let's
stop. Okay. So he's going to go back in the box and never come out again.
Yeah, that's great. That's a good idea. That's a good shout. Yeah. That's a good shout.
Yeah,
it's not my favorite thing on the album. I think it has its place. I don't know.
And that place is in the bit.
if someone said to me, "You got to take one song off the album," would it be this? It might be this. It might be this.
Wouldn't it be the next one?
The next one. We are on to one of the big ones, one of the singles, one of the songs you definitely need coming in, and the closer of side one. But we've already kind of started talking about it on a different episode, because when we were talking about the recording of Lice Rich Pageant, we put on one of the things that they demoed, which was called PSA, and was eventually retitled to Bad Day, and weirdly was another song you knew coming in. And we played it, and I said,
not that weird, it's their biggest song.
I said that you should recognise a portion of the Bad Day demo as something else. So let's just hear the Bad Day demo again quickly to refresh our memories.
A public service announcement followed me home the other day. I paid it, never mind.
It's kind of all you need. That is exactly how It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine opens, unsurprisingly, with snare. Okay? So they had this song, Bad Day, that Michael just couldn't get working. I don't know what it was, but he was like, nah, we're not going to do that. And Peter Buck didn't really want to waste the stuff that he'd written, so he just played the chords backwards and told Michael it was new. and so this song musically is just Bad Day played backwards.
Great.
And here is It's the End of the World as We Know It, parenthesis, and I Feel Fine. Just loads of snare.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not a
some point in our lives, we've all looked up the lyrics and tried to do it.
We
along
just
with
did it.
It.
We were just doing
did
it.
Did you trying. Just doing yeah, it? Yeah.
It's ruined by the fact that when we do it, your then audio gets gated, so we
and
can't hear it anymore.
Out sync, so it's that horrible.
And also, thing. And also, just it's really hard. Even when you're
yeah,
reading along
it
with
it, well,
it's
yeah.
just hard, isn't it?
Hey, it's a classic. Very REM chorus. Those kind of overlapping melodies and lyrics. As the song goes on, as the song continues, that refrain of it's the end of the world as we know it is overtaken, basically, this is what I was saying earlier, it's time I had some time alone. Mike Mills, like he did on Strange for You, just kind of takes center stage by the end of the song. And it's catchy, and it's like a big anthemic sing-along moment, right? And then, of course, you have the verses, which are...
not sing-along. Well, you try.
Not sing along.
You sing along with like the odd line. You sing along with little bits.
Leonard Bernstein. Yeah. You can do that bit, yeah.
You basically do the Homer Simpson version of it, don't you? Where you just sort of make up words eventually.
Yeah. They are so fast, and the lyrics encompass everything. Mm. It's like a full-on stream of consciousness. And yeah, you could pick out bits here and there.
Right.
But I do think it all like... adds up into this kind of intriguing mosaic of the culture at the time. You know, there's overflowing population, there's hurricanes, fires, earthquakes, birds and snakes and aeroplanes, obviously. A world serving its own needs, a government for hire, combat sites, baffled reporters, slashing and burning, TV hour, a tournament of lies, continental drift divide, Leonard Bernstein, and of course... birthday party cheesecake jelly bean boom. And it is a lot. Peter Buck didn't like it. He thought it was so fast that it was too much of a departure for the band.
I'm an idiot.
What do you guys think about it?
I was really wondering when it came into this, because I was like, I listened to it and then I was like, well, it's best song on the album, isn't it? And then was like, is that just because I know it already? And I really tried to get my head around, like, is it just going to be that if I know it, so when we get to the album that's got fucking
Losing My Religion
on it, will that be the highlight because I know it? But then that then leads to the other question of, is the reason I know it because it's
a highlight.
Such a good song, because it's a highlight, and it's a big song, and everyone loves it because it's the better song. So, and I think we'll when we get to the next one, I think I can narrow it down a bit more. But with this one, I think it is just probably the best song on the album. I think it's probably just... it just is. I reckon it's just really good. And so I think that's fine. And I feel fine.
Mm. You feel fine. Yeah. Good.
Yeah. It's the musically, it's actually quite fucking basic. I mean, the bass is all over the place. Bass all over the neck. But like the guitar is just kind of just doing like not a lot. And then the verses is the chorus is like dun 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 dun. It's just four chords. It's like,
yeah,
it's real basic shit.
It is, yeah.
And then the lyrics, and then, but then he's doing the opposite, which is just going fucking.
Well, that's it, isn't it? He's doing the complicated.
Yeah, I think. I think if you had complicated music as well as the complicated vocals, it'd be a bit much. Yeah. It wouldn't be the hit that it is.
The
know?
The whole Bad Day connection is demented. But yeah, they basically kind of just made two songs that's the same song. Well, the DNA of the same song, and they've just kind of gone. And years later, whenever they do that in 2004 or something, they just go. I should know I was there. No, I'd left the band for Editors at that point, hadn't I?
You are a founding member of Editors, then?
It's just mad. That's such a weird thing that exists, and it's their two biggest songs as well. You know,
yeah, crazy.
I've never considered It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. As a song before, because it's just that song. We've talked about the invisible song thing, haven't we? We've talked about the
right.
It's so big. Yeah, we've talked about that quite a bit because everyone knows the chorus. Everyone knows how like there's lots of the fast lyrics and the verse and stuff. It's a great song. It's fun, but it's also really interesting because it's like nice piano over the whole thing. I don't know. I love the backing vocal of it. I love that it's a great side closer. I don't think it's not my favorite song on the album, but I couldn't tell you why. Maybe because it's not new to me. Maybe it's the opposite thing of like I found some stuff I really love in this, so therefore that's the new shiny penny for me. So this feels like kind of I mean, I've enjoyed it every time it's come on, of course, because it's really good. but yeah, I think I don't know. Maybe it's just kind of. It falls back a bit for me for that reason.
So basically, the opposite effect.
Yeah,
to me.
Literally the opposite. I don't know.
In my case, I don't think that is the case. I think genuinely the song would have had. I think it would have been a highlight for me if I had never heard it. I think
it's definitely got a thing as well that you could grasp onto. Yeah,
it's got a thing, and it's in keeping with the. Stuff that you were saying on Life's Rich Pageant where you were like, you were responding to the ones where he was doing fast vocals and they were very up-tempo and energetic.
And verses.
And that's, this is like the natural end point of that kind of
it's
thing.
Like a,
right?
It's like a rap, in it.
It's like a rap, isn't it, basically? It's basically
he's doing
rapping.
Doing a rap.
I think it does a really good job. I think you're right, Steph. I think it's really interesting. It does a really good job of representing culture overload and how it was just kind of impossible to keep track of everything that was going on all of the time. And this was the 80s. Like, it's only gotten worse since then. So it, like, simultaneously feels, like, relevant to today, but also dated because some of the references are quite 80s, you know?
Yeah.
It feels like flicking through TV channels and just seeing snippets of so much stuff, you know, news, entertainment, music, politics, and then summing it up as, like, well, the world is ending, and you know what? I'm fine with it. Like, I'm okay with that.
It's the end of the world as we know it, and I don't mind it, mate.
The other reading is that people are being so, like, placated by this mass media consumption so that even though the world is ending, everyone feels calm and docile and controlled. It's the end of the world, but I feel fine, you know. And then, of course, the time I had some time alone is maybe the expression that you just need. You just got to get away from all of that, you know. You need some time to yourself. You need to isolate from that external force. Here's something. I don't really like it.
Really?
This might be like my You Stole the Sun from My Heart for this season.
Right.
It's a classic. It gets its point across very, very well. It's catchy and it's clever and it's joyful. Don't like it. Maybe it's because I've been listening to REM so much throughout my life, and it's just because I'm the same as you, Steve, and I think just again taken to the logical end point, I've heard this so much that like it's just completely invisible to me. You know, it's just maybe completely overplayed for me. But also, I find the verses to be a touch gimmicky on an album that otherwise kind of isn't gimmicky, and I get a bit tired of REM being that band that did the fast talking song, and I'm just like, yeah, okay, but have you heard like She Just Wants to Be or
Texarkana or something like that. Do you know what I mean? And I also think it's too long for how repetitive it is. In the same way that I didn't need another round of "You stole the sun from my heart, you stole the sun from my heart, you stole the sun from my heart, you stole the sun from my heart," I didn't need more rounds of "It's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it," and I feel fine.
I do like the fake out ending. I do like that when it's just the vocals. And then you've got the harmony.
I don't like it. I might like it more if that's where it finished.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that I've snuck in the middle of you two again. But I've crawled into bed because I've had a nightmare between the two of you. Because I think it's a really great song.
And what was the nightmare?
I didn't like it. It's the end of the world.
Yeah,
you know.
It was.
People are going to be annoyed about that.
It was you, Lucas, dressed as a big silly goose, and you chased me, and I was the golden egg, and Adam.
And
was
I was just going
picking me up, and you were honking. That's my dream.
Lovely
dream. Not a nightmare anymore. It's a dream.
Oh yeah, yeah. I just wanted to tell someone about it, so I came and snuck in between you two. I think it's really good, but it's not my favorite on the album. And it kind of just sinks into the background a little bit. But I do really like it. So that's I can see both sides. Just want to please you both.
I will say that as a closing statement of the chaotic first side on an album called Document that's intended to document the times, works really well for the album. Don't think I would take it off, even though I don't. I kind of just skip it every time that it comes on, really.
Wait, do you not listen to it every time and try desperately to sing along every single word? And if you get it wrong, you skip, you go back to the start of the song and you...
There was a point in my life where I could have done that. I think I did know every word at one point. Yeah, for sure.
You're a maniac.
On to the next side, the leaf side. And I tell you what, it's good to start with a little bit of snare.
This one goes out to the one I've left behind. A simple prop to occupy my time. This one goes out to the one I love. Fire!
It's the one I love by REM. It's like it's the end of the world as we know it, but it's even more so, like even more so the song from this album.
Yeah.
You know, I think I know where Lucas is going with this, but for me, great song, incredible song, which is very funny because I was just whinging about repetition, and this is one of my favorite things on the record because this is
like
this
five
is
lines, isn't
two,
it?
It's two things repeated again and again and again.
It literally is just the same.
But that brutal simplicity is the point of this one, I think. How did you guys get on with it?
My notes have also got the word brutal in it.
Yeah.
But in a different bit, which is a simple prop to occupy my time. Because that is a brutal line.
And the build to it as well. Because it's basically a subversion of love songs, right? And the pop love song. So it's a repetitive pop song. Just like those love songs that just repeat the same things again and again and again. And people lap them up. But it's bleak. And it's just a total subversion of that. And it's a turn. It's because it builds up to that line that it feels brutal. You wouldn't necessarily know immediately what was happening on your first listen. It's "this one goes out to the one I love." Aw, mm-hmm. That's nice. Yeah. "This one goes out to the one I left behind." Yeah. Okay, aw, but sad, you know. "A simple prop to occupy my time." And he was like, "Oh, okay. Jesus Christ, that is brutal." And then it turns again, doesn't it? There's one line change in the whole thing. In the final verse, he says, "Another prop has occupied my time." And that's why I think the repetition works so well, is because this is not about one person. This is about a succession of people that the narrator is doing to. He's doing this to them again and again and again and again. Yeah, it just reduces the person to an object, right?
Yes.
And a trivial object at that. Trivial.
Adam, where am I going with this?
I think that like the first few listens, you're like, oh, I know the one I love, so it must be a song that I like. But actually, the more you listen to it, the more repetitive and simple it gets, and that's just kind of not enough for you. And actually, this is one time where the familiarity didn't mean that you automatically liked it.
Spot on.
Yeah.
Became a simple prop to occupy
which gets shows to show though that it's not just familiarity.
Mm.
It's just having a thing. It's having a hook, maybe. It's something to get me. As we discovered, song about a monkey. I'm going to remember it's about a monkey.
Song
and
that's about
give
a
me
monkey.
And again, the song is not about a monkey.
Yeah.
It's
song's about a monkey.
It mentions monkeys.
The song's about a little Dunstan who's not a monkey. He is an orangutan, by the way, though, Steve. I did look it up.
I know.
Like, well done. Thank you.
I wore my VHS copy out. It's great.
What does that mean?
Where were you going?
I thought you meant you wore it out.
I put it on as an outfit and wear it out. It's just the videotape and duct tape.
But yeah, no. It's interesting to know that it's not just that I know the song, so it's one that is a highlight. And then that actually led me to go and think back to previous albums that we've done from other bands and stuff. And go, okay, Radiohead, for example. There were certain songs that I knew like throughout the career, but they weren't always the highlights on albums.
Yeah.
Or even to go to like A Design for Life, I was like, yeah, it's good.
It's good.
But like, I don't think I put that as the highlight on that album. I think I picked some like new ones, shiny new ones, shiny, happy new ones.
Yeah.
So it is definitely just going to show it's not necessarily just a familiarity thing. It's just that often the songs that you're familiar with because they're generally good.
Lucas, I've got news for you. That's how music sort of, or the music industry sort of works. You put out a single so that people buy the album and they listen to that song because they're familiar with it, and then they slowly warm up to all of the songs that surround it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair. Yeah, but you are kind of right that the actual song itself, if I look at it kind of objectively and forget the fact that,
I know this one.
Yeah. I think I would say, oh, it's just kind of a bit of a standard, not that interesting, ploddy, boring, not boring, but not bad, but like fine, you know? I think
this is one of those things where it is very simple. It's very repetitive. We've had, by the way, I remembered where this analogy came from. It comes from Flea of the Red Hot Chili Peppers. We mentioned it in our Atoms for Peace episode. The whole thing about getting you in your head, heart, and your balls.
Mm-hmm.
That's where that comes from. We've constantly been quoting Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers on that one. But this one does not get me in the head. This is all heart and balls.
Yeah.
This is just that opening riff, the little downturn in intensity for the verses, and then the absolute explosion of the chorus that is just the word fire that is absolutely howled by Michael Stipe. I just think it's great. It just gets me, like, I don't have to think about it. It just gets me in the chest, you know? And I think he's talking about, like, the cleansing version of fire. Although, actually, no, maybe it's the destructive version of fire, actually. Like, cleansing yourself or destroying a relationship.
Passion as well. I think that comes into it. The fire of relationships.
Oh,
and, that's
interesting.
That's what I kind of drew from it. It's potentially another invisible song, but it is really, really good, isn't it? And I hadn't ever considered it was the same part over and over, even though I've heard it over and over before, until I've sat down a few times to listen to it for this. But
yeah,
but like, you're right. There's beauty in repetition of when you slightly change things. So yes, that line changed towards the end. Little things like, I mean, I like how he does the fire bit and just comes in whenever the fuck he likes with it. Because like, he'll just come in halfway through a fire. Oh God. But also just like switching up when he goes left, space, behind, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. There's a chord change in it that just gets me in my heart and my balls. And it's just coming out of the verse. So when it goes back down to the second time he says this one goes out to the one I love, in that it just comes down. I don't know what it is. It's really, really nice.
Do you know what? I think it changes because the verse is just E minor, D, E minor, D. And then I think that bit changes to a C.
Right.
And it just opens up a little bit.
Right.
Just lovely.
Yeah. There you go. I wouldn't say it's not a highlight again because I just don't want it to be. So there.
You want to be cool. You're like, oh, yeah, no, I guess the one I love is fine, but actually I really like Lightning Hopkins or something like that. Is that what you're going to do?
Well, no, I said the one I love is Welcome to the Occupation. What are you...
Wait, hang on. The one I love is Welcome to the Occupation. Are they the same
song?
Yeah,
that's the one I love.
Okay. I can't... Steve...
What? I can't have my
I'll
cake
let you off
eat
because
it.
It's in the second episode. Yeah, yeah. I'll let you off because it's in the second part, but we won't be doing it again, actually.
Hey, guess what? It's a really good start to the Leaf side, isn't it?
It really is, and we must shout him out again because we are the world's leading unofficial Mike Mills podcast. The bass in this is absolutely fucking bass. Incredible.
The that thing you say about head, heart, and balls actually is interesting because I was then starting thinking about it, and I think no REM song has yet hit me in all three.
Fair.
I think I'm waiting for that song that still hits me in my head, heart, and balls.
Ooh, and when we get there, you'll implode. Mm. You'll just be a mess of jelly on the floor.
I think the one that's missing is Heart. I don't think any have hit me in my heart yet.
Really? Nothing has made you feel anything?
I don't know if they have, really. And even the ones that in Balls, I still don't think anything's really given them a good squeeze.
Okay, all right. Okay, then anyway.
They just slapped them a bit.
Okay, so also,
when, you know, the brutal line, a simple prop to occupy my time.
Yeah.
I don't know about you guys. Did you immediately start thinking, like, about your own history and start thinking if you've ever been on the receiving or the giving end of that really brutal statement? I immediately ran through my exes and went, oh, yeah.
Should we list them?
Yeah.
Right, anyway.
Yeah, all right. Right. I was on the receiving end with.
anyway, look.
But then the follow up, then the one after, though, is the. Because I was hurt, I was then on the giving end of that.
Hey, man, everybody hurts.
Sometimes.
Fireplace.
In terms of form, though, this one, the one I love, absolutely built for radio, right? Like, the riff is catchy and it's instantly recognizable and it's all very simple and it's easy to sing. It's 3 minutes long. It has the big drums, the clear production. You can hear every word of it. There's no mistaking a lot of it. Soaring harmonies in the chorus when they bring in even more lyrics. And it was a huge radio hit. It was their first ever hit.
Not in Europe, though, right?
Yeah, but Europe is a different sort of thing. We'll get to that.
Because there is no radio in Europe.
It's free of it.
Okay, yeah, all right. Okay, yeah, yeah. Not bad.
Point.
This, look, it came up. It came up organically, okay? I'm not doing this, and I'm not even going to say his name, okay? But the song sometimes gets compared to Born in the USA, okay? Because it's got like a huge radio-friendly sound. We can all sing Born in the USA. And it has surface-level appeal to the lyrics because a lot of people just went, it's a nice love song. And then there's deeper meaning for those who look for it. I think it's difficult to miss on this one, but loads of people think it's a nice love song, so that's fine.
Oh, I bet it was so many people's like first dance and stuff because they were like, oh,
I hope so.
It's the one I
love. Oh, God, I bet.
Hang on. You want to do a first dance at a wedding and you stick on this?
Oh, people have done it.
What kind of fucking dance are you doing, mate?
The 80s.
What are you doing?
We're doing this.
My first dance, I wanted an upbeat song for my first dance. I'd have been more up for that. I wanted a bit of a boog.
Really? A boog? Just a quick boog?
Yeah, I wanted a little bit of a boog. And Hannah wanted the slowest, you know, most...
Ed Sheeran
song.
I heard it was Ed Sheeran.
We managed to settle somewhere in the middle. So, you know, that's love.
Hi, Adam here. I'm interrupting this episode of our music podcast to talk to you about different music. It's just all music all the time on this podcast. I want to talk to you about Small Miracles, a band from Cardiff that I really like. They're a new wave kind of band, but then they bring in all these elements of punk and glam and grunge. I mean, Talking Heads meets Pixies, The Cure meets Queens of the Stone Age, maybe that kind of thing. It's difficult to describe, which I think is the case for all of the best bands. If you're a fan of Manic Street Preachers, Radiohead, Muse,
REM. I mean, most of the music that we've covered on this podcast, if you like it, there's a good chance that you will like Small Miracles. And I've got some good news for you, because they are about to make their long-form debut. Having released a bunch of singles, they're about to release Live at Rockfield EP on Dirty Carrot Records. And this is an EP of four tracks that were captured in whole takes live in the studio. And they kind of showcase the range of the band, as well as that sort of tight intensity that they've kind of built their live reputation on. You don't necessarily have to take my word for it. They're playing Beneath Me right now. That's the music you can hear. Why don't I just shut up and we can hear a bit of that? I think that sounds great. That's just one of the four tracks on this EP. The EP can be streamed on all platforms, like all music can these days. But if you want to do something a little bit more special, you can search Small Miracles Dirty Carrot, Small Miracles Dirty Carrot, and you can order a copy of the vinyl of the EP. And all proceeds from that vinyl will fund the band's upcoming debut album. So that's pretty cool. But whichever way you listen to it, I hope you enjoy it. Live at Rockfield EP by Small Miracles. Go and have a listen. The lyrics are so not a love song that they considered not giving it the full rock song treatment, like not the full anthemic sort of thing. And they also recorded an acoustic version, which is very interesting. If you get the chance to dig that out, because they've played it. They've played an acoustic version a couple of times. And actually for live shows, that's how they open the song. Very slow and sparse. And then it explodes into that first chorus and the version that we know. The producer, Scott Litt, bet Bill Berry that it would be a top 40 radio hit. And Bill Berry was like, no, there's no way. And it was. And Litt said, people would laugh, but I never had a problem hearing that record on top 40 radio between a Whitney Houston song and something else. The beauty of it being that it's so simple and stark. Yeah, there you go. The One I Love. Just a kind of an all-time great song, in my opinion. It always is always in those polls that are like the greatest songs of the 80s and stuff like that. Just an untouchable kind of song, in my opinion. Okay? Having said that, I'm not sure it reaches the top 10 that we're going to do at the end of the fifth year.
Okay. It was, we'll see. You said about it was that it did reach the top 40. It was in the top 10, wasn't it? It was their first top 10.
Yeah, we'll get to it. Yeah. But he didn't bet it would reach top 10. He said he bet it was in the top 40.
Spoilers.
Anyway, it's difficult to come off the back of The One I Love, but here is Fireplace. Snare. REM from the album Document.
Document.
Much kind of there's a darker. I mean, in general, this is the second side is a bit darker in like mood and tone, I think. And this, I've seen this described as a hard rock song, and it for sure has that kind of edge. But obviously, one of the most notable things about the song is the free jazz saxophone keeps coming in. I'll try and find a bit of it. I think towards the end is when it gets, quite intense. Here we go.
Thank you.
Now, it's not quite as alarming, but it did definitely remind me of the National Anthem by Radiohead.
Mm-hmm.
The way that they both sort of devolve into chaotic, horn-led sort of jams. And I don't want to cast aspersions. I don't want to say that anybody did anything or whatever. But 1987, I believe, is the year that On a Friday hired three saxophone players. So I am wondering if they heard Document and went, that sounds fucking cool as fuck. I think it's like a nice new expansion of the sound. The only other place we've heard horns before is Fables of the Reconstruction. And the saxophone is played by Steve Berlin, who was told by the band, do whatever you want. So what do you think of it?
Do whatever you want.
I'll probably play the saxophone if that's all right.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, you can.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
So, for me, we've had 7 out of 7 songs so far. Incredible run, ridiculous. This is just where it falls off a cliff. The album for me, I think
brutal.
You can't deny the saxophone. The saxophone saves the song. I think otherwise, it's just a bit rubbish. I think like crazy,
really?
Crazy world, crazy, crazy times. After we've had like all of the complex lyrics and stuff so far, talking about that thing, to have it just sort of laid out there like that, to me just sort of seems a bit meh.
Does it make a difference that you didn't write it?
Maybe. I mean, it won't change that way I like the song or not, but
it's based on a speech from the 18th century that was made by Mother Anne Lee, who led a religious sect called the Shakers.
I wish the saxophone was on it. I don't know. Yeah, I like that part of it, and I'm always a bit like, oh, when this one comes on, because I'm like, I don't know if I'm saying it's rubbish. The fact that I've got rubbish is harsh. I'm doing it again where I just completely backtrack, but like where it's been so strong so far,
he's gonna make it highlight.
Yeah, it's the best thing I've ever heard. It's been so strong so far coming up to this, you know, that it's like, okay, fine, right, now we're on just like a downward trajectory, I guess.
What's interesting, just to cut in there for a second, is that I agree that there's a mood shift here. And I don't, it's not where I stop liking the album, but it is where the album becomes a little bit more difficult.
I also agree.
It's where the album becomes a little bit more experimental.
Yes, the saxophone's doing some jazz, but the song isn't experimental, in my opinion. I think the song is sort of nothing without the saxophone.
Sure, but it has the saxophone.
Yeah, it's true.
So we don't live in a world where it doesn't have the saxophone.
Imagine living in that world.
I weirdly, with this one, have like very little to say about it, except that I like it, but I don't really know why. Because there's, like Steve said, there's not like an enormous amount to it apart from the saxophone. Although, as we said, we do live in a world where the saxophone is in
yeah,
the song.
That's true. Yeah, we do.
So we can't really say apart from the saxophone, because the saxophone is not apart from it. It is a part of it. But just like, it's just good. I don't really know. Just,
yeah.
It's just kind of low key good.
Yeah.
I don't really have an enormous amount to say why or why it particularly picked up on it or anything. Maybe it's because the song had a thing that made me glom onto it. And
oh, it's the saxophone one. Yeah. It does chug along a little bit. And yeah, the bit that grabs you is you go, oh, yeah, the saxophone. It comes in and it just livens the whole thing up. But I think that's, you know, the thought process that they had, because the saxophone came on like quite late. It's not written around the saxophone, but they added it because I think the song is a little bit plodding on its own.
Yeah.
But I really like this a lot. It really surprised me because it's not one of the songs that I knew too well going into the deep dive of Document. But I really like the dark tone of it, and then the way that's countered with the harsh brightness of the saxophone. And I like the lyrics too, that this is fully like fire as a destructive force. And it's kind of built similarly, I think, to the one I love, in that it's two refrains strung together. But the arrangement of those things, or the arrangement in general actually, isn't as simple as the one I love. But it hinges on crazy world, crazy times, which, you know, is vague but applicable. And then each time the next section repeats, it changes slightly. You get hang up your chairs to better sweep. Clear the floor to dance. Always the same. That's always always the same. And then shake the rug into the fireplace. So you're kind of getting rid of or destroying the stuff that you've swept away. And then that last line changes every time that refrain comes around. Sweep the floor into the fireplace, throw the chairs into the fireplace, throw the walls into the fireplace. So suddenly your whole house has gone into the fire, even though you were supposed to just shake the rug. And it's a really nice escalation of imagery. And it speaks to processes that once started can't be stopped or end up engulfing things in totality. And every time the things that go into the fireplace become a bit more drastic, the saxophone gets more violent. It's a really interesting escalation across the whole song, which I really
like. Yeah, I mean, what I really like about it,
and you do really like it, and it is your favorite on the
really
album.
Love this one, my favorite song, because the thing is, right, this isn't one of my lowlights. So I think it's because I've come off this incredible run that it just took a downward turn. But what I really like is the everything's being swept into the fireplace. The song just does just end up, I mean, you said it got more violent. It's the same thing. I'm saying the same thing. The song ends up on fire, and it's just a massive just mess towards the end. And it's just ablaze, which is really cool. And I really like that. I really like what's the hang up your chairs to better sweep.
Yes, clear the floor to
like
dance.
He doesn't just say, sweep better. I like it when he does that, and I know that that is. I know it. It
That's
works
from the speech.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Okay. Of course. Yeah. But I do like the way that kind of is played as a lyric. That's quite good. Again, it's not a low light, but I was like,
I will repeat what I said before we played it. Difficult to come off the back of The One I Love,
right? I wonder how much of that is it. And I think like after The One I Love being that good, and then I got crazy World, I'm like, oh, come on.
Yeah, I guess. But then, no, because the lyrics of The One I Love are really good.
Yeah.
But This One Goes Out to The One I Love is equally kind of simplistic and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's just where it's placed on the album. But I do think that Fireplace is where the album starts to become more difficult, and Lightning Hopkins continues that, King of Birds continues that, and Oddfellows Local 151 100% continues all of that. We'll continue with Lightning Hopkins. Let's have a bit of snare, shall we? Definitely have not heard REM sound a lot like that before, right?
No.
Yeah, that's a real change of pace.
Is that a double bass drum?
No, the bass guitar's going dubba 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 dum, and he's going dubba 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 dum.
It's a synth. It's actually a synth. It's them fucking around with a Fairlight, which is like this synthesizer that was retro even for the time. It was made in like 1979, and it came with its own CRT screen that could only display like green text, you know. It's one of those. Man, this sounds like the fucking 90s to me. That opening is like something you would expect to hear on a 90s metal album. This is the one that for me sounds like Gold Against the Soul. And the guitar on it is all like twisty riffs and not very REM at all, which is quite novel, I think. And I think when placed next to Fireplace and the next one, actually, it represents a nice expansion of sound. It's them kind of bringing in stuff that we haven't really heard before. How did you guys respond to this? The first time I heard it on this deep dive, I was like honestly quite alarmed by it, because it sounds so little like REM.
Yeah.
When I first heard it, and I was like, oh, double bass, or what I thought was double bass drum, I was like, and then it was like some riffs. I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Am I going to love this? Is this going to be my shit? And then actually, kind of annoys me. The woes really piss me off. I hate a woe. It's got some of his most egregious, and it sounds mean because it sounds like I'm just taking the piss out of his accent. But like, it's some of his most egregious. Row! Like he sounds like a cat.
His growl sounds very. He's like forcing a growl in this lyric. It's not really necessarily his accent. It sounds strange.
He's affecting that voice. And do you know what? We've heard it before. It reminds me of that song that we heard on Dead Letter Office, Burning Hell.
Yeah.
The one that was a parody of metal songs. Yeah. And he's doing the same thing. Only this one isn't that funny. Or maybe it is. I don't know. But he's doing the same voice. In general, I just don't know what they were thinking with this one.
Yeah.
It's a reasonably unpleasant listen. Which I'm not against in principle. I'm not fully against an unpleasant listen, as you know. But I don't think the content of the song carries that tone successfully. The song itself just seems a bit weak. And so it's just here because of its sound. Because it sounds a bit heavy. Because it sounds riffy and kind of heavy. That's why it's here. Because they want to be, look, we're kind of a heavier band now. I don't know if you know, but we play rock music. It does get points for sounding like the 90s, because again, I must remind you, it was 1987.
Okay.
I mean, the other thing, I did have money on you loving this, Lucas, because it sounds like Symphony of Tourette from Gold Against the Soul, which you liked famously. But there's also, Lucas, mate, there's a James Bond bit. And you love James Bond.
Yeah, you're the James Bond guy.
You're the James Bond guy. There's a James Bond bit, Lucas. And in the James Bond bit, it features one of those wooden fish percussion things that you love.
Oh, it's...
Yeah, you must have loved it. Do you want to hear it? Do you want to hear the James Bond with the fish?
James Bond guy?
Here it is. Here it is.
Why am I the James Bond guy, though?
Did I not notice that?
And a lovely wooden fish as well. Incredible, incredible. You must have loved that.
Just remind everyone that Adam is the one who watched every single James Bond film back to back.
Yeah, but it makes sense.
Lucas, I've seen your letterbox list of, it's called My Top 100 Movies. The top 26 are all James Bond movies.
And there's James Bond films I've not even seen.
That's not true. Then why are they in the list then, Lucas? Sense. Then why
I
are they?
I just love it so much. I just love it so much. I feel that they deserve representing.
I tell you what, though, the bass absolutely fucks. I think that bass is honestly, it's like a new metal riff. Honestly, is listen to it because it incorporates a bit of slap and it's a bit heavy and it might be in drop D. It's just it is. It is something.
Tell you what, it needed. It needed a saxophone to save it.
It really did. It really did. Yeah. Lightning Hopkins was a blues musician. But I don't see much of him in the song aside from the title. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe people on Twitter will let me know.
This is Lightning One.
Yep. It did leak its way into the arrangement a little bit because Peter was inspired to play slide guitar for the song, which is interesting. And it's an interesting bit of energy to inject into the second half of the album. I don't like it. Do you like it? No, Lucas, you said you found it annoying. Steve, what do you think of it?
Annoying. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Not for me.
So the next song is called King of Birds, parenthesis, a blessed relief from the snare.
For a second you had me.
Young, there's time to teach point to point, point on.
there's so much like overlapping vocal business going on there.
Yeah.
And I'm here for it.
Are you? That's lucky.
Why is that lucky?
You'll find out.
Oh no. What?
Nothing, mate.
The overlapping vocal business I'm here for, but on the whole, the song is a bit only okay.
That's unlucky.
What does all this mean? like standing on the shoulders of giants for Michael Stipe, this song leaves me cold. I was very pleased with that. Nothing from you guys.
I didn't really fully grasp what you said, I'll be honest. I think you rushed it. Do you want to try it again?
Yeah. Just like...
Quicker, you're dragging.
Standing on the shoulders of giants for Michael Stipe, this song leaves me cold.
Because earlier on...
I'll go into the lyrics. Fuck me. Standing on the shoulders of giants leaves me cold.
That just like Stipe standing on a
cold giant. It's one of those awkward sentences. It's like that amid highlight is this,
perhaps it's telling.
Yeah, it's that. It's a sentence that just isn't quite clicking and there's something wrong with it.
Just like standing on the shoulders of giants for Michael Stipe, this song leaves me cold.
Yeah, I think...
This pants is telling.
You've made it clear that there's a comma there, and I think when you first said it, you rushed it, and so that comma wasn't felt, and it was...
Okay,
yeah.
I'll try again. One more time. It's quite a nice vibe.
Yeah, okay, cool.
All right.
This is, like, full-on folk mode, right? Like, I guess it gets kind of folk rock, or maybe even folk grunge. I think I guess you'd call it a chorus, is a bit grungy. If you want to be hyper-specific, you could call it that. But that opening sound is undeniably very folk and not like Mumford and Sons or even Bob Dylan. It's like medieval knights and bards kind of folk, you know?
Early Fleet Foxes album is very medieval.
No, it's not though. Peter Buck, who is REM, was playing around with new instruments to play and he landed on this. It's a dulcimer. It's a very old stringed instrument played in the lap. Do you know what a dulcimer kind of sounds like?
I do now because I've heard this song and I looked up what it was when I read the research for this song.
You think about that? Of course you know what a dulcimer sounds like because you've just been listening to it.
We just played
the instrument in this song. Yeah.
This song sounds like this.
I've Googled it. It is an incredible looking instrument, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Fair warning to you, and this is what I was saying about lucky, unlucky, him playing a dulcimer here opened the door for him to explore even more instruments like it, and thus begins the mandolin years.
I'd seen that.
Yes, for a few years after this, you could not get Peter Buck away from mandolins and other oldie world folk instruments like a lute.
E.g. Losing My Religion.
Yeah, Losing My Religion and, you know, a lot of other stuff. You'll see. We're entering the mandolin years, guys. Are you not excited?
I'm excited.
About that?
In real life now.
Yes.
And we're now entering the mandolin years.
It's a golden age for the mandolin, what I've been told. It reminds me of Finest Work song a little bit. Very small verses and then a dramatic chorus that kind of builds. And because there's more instrumentation that kicks in on Standing on the Shoulders of Giants Leaves Me Cold, which is one of the lyrics from the songs, Lucas. And then it all builds for 100 million birds fly away, which is like a very dramatic kind of thing. And then it also reminds me of Feeling Gravity's Pull, because eventually that bit that builds gives way to quite a pretty sound that wasn't there before. The lyrics, fairly inscrutable in my opinion, but they have a nice rhythm to them.
It's about birds.
I mean, it might just be about birds
one's
in the same
monkey,
way that the Heron House
about
is about monkeys. You've got monkeys, you've got birds.
Heron House, not about birds, funnily.
But king of birds.
About monkeys.
Not really about birds, but about person, surely. Because he's the king of birds, unless the king
and
of birds
what are
is
people
he?
If not but intelligent monkeys?
Oh, it's all monkeys all the way down. This is what we said. It's fine, you know?
He's got a good voice at times. I mean, he's got a good voice on the whole, but yeah. I mean, sometimes he doesn't when he goes. But when he does the away, the big away in this song.
Yeah, that's quite special. Yeah, yeah.
Well done, Michael.
Well done.
Good job. Good job.
It's a nice vibe. It's just not, it's not very fun. And I've been having fun, you know?
Okay, yeah.
Which is fine. Which, you know, that shouldn't be a reason to put it down. But yeah, I think, like you said, it's fine.
It should. All media needs to be fun.
Yeah. It's one of the longest things on the album. And, you know, come on. Like, let's trim this one just a little bit.
I really like the shuffly drums, the kind of military kind of shuffly drums.
It's and like then a march, yeah.
And then the juxtaposition of that coming out into that structured 4/4 beat. And that always sounds nice. Because you get some sort of order again. So it does that quite a lot, which is quite great. The 100 million birds bit and stuff. But otherwise,
I think it's a classic sort of like second to last track on an album. You can get away with something a little bit weirder, a bit more experimental when you're just about to wrap things up, you know?
Yeah.
And we are about to wrap things up with the last track. And I tell you what, there's no snare. There's no snare, guys. There's a few.
There's also no rap.
There's no rap. We haven't hit any rap. Anyway, here's the last track on the album, Oddfellows Local 151. Closer, isn't it? It's a moody closer. Now, this really sounds like 90s alternative rock. You can hear that, right? Yeah. It sounds like grunge.
It sounds grunge. It's grungy. Yeah. It sounds dirgy.
It sounds like that whole 90s rock scene. Like, it sounds like this to some degree. And again, I must remind you, it's 1987.
If you put a little AI voice filter on so that it sounded like Kurt Cobain singing instead of Michael Stipe, I feel like it'd pass.
100%. It passes. Like, oh, we've uncovered this new Nirvana song no one's ever heard before.
Yeah.
And do you know what? It is 1987, but it's really just building on sounds that they had been using for a little while. Like, this is another example of what I think is like the mood of Fables of the Reconstruction with the production of Life's Rich Pageant. They've kind of fused those two things at times on this album for me. It is a truly menacing bass line, and the guitar really matches with this kind of like sparse playing and the violent drums. Again, Holy Bible adjacent, I think. And we're seven years before the Holy Bible, you know? There's that feedback that runs through the whole thing, and they're just pushing the more avant-garde edge to their sound here. There's a bit where Stipe is just going net 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 net, which is quite aggressive, really. Like, they're sort of pushing it a little bit. What did you think?
It's not necessarily to my taste. Which again is weird because I do like Nirvana, and like I just said, if you stuck Kurt Cobain's voice on it, you could definitely pass this off as a Nirvana song. So that's weird. But it's weird and it goes on for too long. But I also do like that at least the last track is doing a thing, which I am always one for. My notes here say weird that it takes ages to end, but that snakes it a final track at least. I think I meant to write makes it a final track.
No, I like
for some reason, I was just thinking
absolutely
about
snakes it.
I was just thinking about snakes.
Yeah. Herons, monkeys, and snakes.
It's all over. Birds, yeah, so it's like it's aeroplanes. Not like a highlight, and it's not like it's fine that it's at least the end is doing it. If it was just like another not that interesting song, then it'd be boring. But at least it's doing a thing, even if the thing isn't the second half. Though I really didn't think about it until how much you pointed out that the second half is so different to the first.
Yeah, yeah.
The what the album? You mean?
Yeah, the album. Yeah,
yeah. What about you, Steve?
I think it may be my least favourite thing on the album, which is a shame.
Wrong.
Because on a whole, I've really enjoyed the album, and I think it is that sludgy feeling of it. I think it's just a bit of a downer to go out on quite a weird and fun album. But maybe I'm wrong and calling it a weird and fun album, because the second half of the... But I think... Oh, yeah.
I think weird is correct, but I think everything from The One I Love onwards is weird and dark and naughty.
Yeah.
It's the second half, isn't it?
Yeah. Just not for me. I appreciated what it was doing, and it was different, and it's cool that REM is still doing this stuff on album 5, and they haven't completely shed it.
So,
I'm there for that.
Nice.
This seems like another one of those character songs about weird local people that may or may not be true. What was the guy that before?
Bingo.
About the,
is it Bango?
Yeah.
Bongo.
The Independent Order of Odd Fellows.
Yeah, that's what it is.
What was the one about the guy who had a house split in half and then
life and how to live
at night? And so it sort of it gave me that. Is it that?
It has that touch of Southern Gothic.
Who's Pee-wee?
To it. Well, It has that touch of Southern Gothic to it in that they're kind of talking about these mysterious older men in their deep south hometown of Athens, Georgia. The Independent Order of Odd Fellows, was a secret society like the Masons, and they had a branch in Athens, and they met behind the firehouse. And they also call out a specific guy called Pee-wee, who is just another character from the local area. Peter Buck talks about him. That song is actually about all these winos who used to live down the street from us. They used to live in cars. We call them the Motor Club. These old guys would sleep in the cars and drink all the time. I think there was a guy called Pee-wee as well. Michael knew them because he used to live right next door to them. Every once in a while, you'd give them $5 or drop off a bottle of something. So there you okay. go. So I think this would have fit squarely onto Fables of the Reconstruction.
Yeah, yeah.
But the production that it's given here means that it's much kind of easier actually to grab hold of what it is they're doing, which I think makes it a great closer to the album. The last minute or so, I'm not convinced if you just heard it somewhere, like you're in a shop and you heard it on the radio, that you'd go, hey, it's REM.
No.
You know? I challenge the assertion that everything they do sounds the same, even at this point. 4.5 years in, I'll play a little bit at the end. That guitar. Guitar sounds great. The one in the right ear cup is kind of like just doing those kind of violent strums. And then it kind of just sort of fades away. And that's the end of the album. That's the end of Document by REM. Guys, what did you make of Document by REM? Give me your thoughts. Give me your lowlights. Give me your highlights. Give me your scores.
I've not been too hot on the last 4 or so songs, but I really loved my time with this album. I think it's definitely a band leaning into the commercial and more rock sounding, but also bringing back more of, we've talked about it, the weirdness and the experimental tendencies. So it's accessible, but it also challenges you. And that's, like I said, it's very cool on album 5. And I think that's a great mix for an album, right? Something that has something to grab onto and is a bit interesting, but actually you could stick on this album and have commercial success, I guess. We've talked before about how Postcards from a Young Man by the Manics was, they were very hot on let's just go commercial success and there's just nothing behind it, and I said you can still do that and do something interesting as well, which is what this album's doing. I really struggled with scoring it because of the back half, because I don't hate those songs, I just really loved the first 7. So I'm not really sure what to do here.
Now that's not necessarily, I know I'm going to pick you up on like a word that you said, that's not the back half, that is 4 tracks out of 11, which is not a bad hitting rate, you know.
That's true. That is very true. I like it more than Fables, definitely. I don't like it more than the other three. So where do I put it?
Same.
It's so...
You put 10 out of 10, probably.
You probably
10 oh, yeah, 10. Sorry, it's 10, because that's math. I think it's so strong, 1 to 7. So I'm leaning between... I wish I didn't go first. Then I could just go closer to what you guys did.
I think that means disparity.
Well, 7.75.
No, we're not doing so. You do 7.5 or an 8 there, I think.
Oh, what should I do?
I like how we added 0.5s to help with these situations now. And now we're in situations where we're struggling between.
Use the words.
Use your words.
Use
your words.
From what you've said about it, it doesn't sound like you're going great, but you do think it's good. Do you think that's all it is?
It's solidly good.
It's better than good, but it's not great. Says the 7.5. Right, lovely. Okay, good. We got there in the end.
Okay. Use your words. Fuck. Come on.
You got any lowlights or highlights, Steve? Usually we do those first.
God, it's so weird to call that 7.5 because I... Oh, that's fine. That is fine. I can change it.
Fine would be like 6, probably.
5.56, I think it's fine. Yeah,
okay. For fuck's sake. Lowlights, Lightning Hopkins.
Yes.
And Odd Fellows.
Sure. Why not?
Highlights. I'm avoiding the big ones and going with Welcome to the Occupation and Disturbance in the Heron House. Monkeys, monkeys, monkeys.
Monkeys, 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 monkeys indeed. Monkeys, monkeys. Lucas, hit me with some thoughts. Lowlights, highlights, and a score.
On the whole, whilst there's very little that I like disliked or sort of a negative on, only really like Lightning Hopkins annoyed me.
Yeah.
There's also not that much I really felt that strongly on either. Like, I mean, obviously there's a few, but for the most part, it was very much like, yep, that was another album. Let's hope the next one gets me more in my head, balls and, what was it? Head, bum and balls.
Yeah,
head, heart
bum.
And balls.
Gets me in my bum. Yeah.
Let's hope the next one gets me more in my head, heart, bum and balls.
What is bum?
Like, I'm just still waiting for that, like, that one where I'm just like, you know, heck yeah, you know? You know, with Mannix, it took, what, 4 albums to get there, effectively.
Mm. Tracks 1 to 7 go heck yeah.
Not for me, they're still, you know. Oh, it's for you, certainly the first, certainly the first half is better than the latter, I would definitely agree. That is a valid point. But on the whole, I still come away from it just being like, yeah, that's fine. Didn't have a bad time, didn't have a good time. I had a time listening to it. Low lights would be like, well, the one that annoyed me, I guess, Lightning Hopkins. Fine,
sure. Wow. triple low light. That doesn't happen often.
You haven't said that yet.
Oh, sorry. Spoilers.
And I don't know, like, strange because it annoys me also.
That it's a cover.
For a different reason.
Yeah, okay.
And then highlights would be It's the End of the World as We Know It. Obf. And probably maybe Exhuming McCarthy.
Oh, lovely. That's cool. making the playlist. I had some questions about the Lucas playlist, actually.
Bear in mind, for REM, that playlist is yet to exist.
Right. This is what I had a question about, right? Because when we summed up Murmur, you were like, obviously there's some that will make the playlist, there's some absolute playlist bait in there, but there's more that I don't like or whatever. When we got to Reckoning, you were like, there's like 5 songs from this that will make the playlist, and we were like, wow, that's like half the album, that's crazy. And then when we got to Fables, you went, I've not made the playlist, I will never put anything from REM in a playlist. So what happened to the playlist? Did you delete it?
No, but I was obviously talking about the hypothetical playlist in those first two cases. I was going, this would make the playlist, which I have to make.
Right.
And then the Fables one, I was obviously just having a downtime and was just going, no, I'm not going to make the playlist.
Because then there's loads of stuff from Life Switch Pageant which would make your playlist, I reckon. Because absolutely. That whole thing you said about head, heart, balls and bum, and it taking to the fourth Mannix album for you to get there, the fourth REM album you rate almost equally to Everything Must Go.
Oh, don't talk about the scores. I hate it. Which I'm about to have to do one. Also, though,
do
to be
one.
Clear, the playlist is more of an idea than an actual thing.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's to more be clear,
of a state of mind.
Yeah, because to be clear, I have made, in the seasons we have done this show, one of the playlists, and it's Manics.
Oh, right, okay.
Muse
fine.
Never had one for obvious reasons. Billy, it was bloody 2 seconds long. Lauren was 2 seconds long, and Radiohead, cool, the playlist is every song.
Yeah, okay, it's everything except Pablo Honey, except Creep. Yeah, okay, cool.
And then score, I think just based on that description I gave it, I just can't see why I'd give it anything other than a 5. Because
yeah, wow.
I described it as neutral, you know?
So there's two albums that you prefer to this.
Lightswitch Pageant and Reckoning would make it higher, right?
Yes, exactly. And you are bang on the same score as Murmur. Yes. Yeah.
Sounds fine. Sounds fine.
Lovely stuff.
That feels okay in my head, heart, balls and bum.
On today's episode, I'd like to talk to you about Buzzsprout, the user-friendly podcast hosting for non-techie people. I think that if this podcast has achieved anything, it's showing that literally anybody can start a podcast. Do you need any previous experience? No. Do you need top-of-the-range audio equipment? No. Do you need entertaining or insightful content? Absolutely not. But there is one thing that you will need, and that's podcast hosting, or somewhere to store your podcast and deliver them to all of those podcast places, like the one where you're listening to this now. So if you're thinking about starting a podcast, just do it. We here at Big Mates Enterprises use Buzzsprout to host and publish our podcast because it's the best and easiest way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Your show can be online and listed on all the major podcast directories within minutes of finishing your recording. That's Apple Podcast, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Castbox, Pocket Cast, Podbean, Podcast Addict. The list goes on and on. The other thing we've found is that not only do you get useful and easy to understand statistics about how well your podcast is doing, but also that the support team is super helpful with somebody always on hand to answer questions and help our podcast succeed. Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout to get their message to the world, and you'll get a great-looking podcast website, audio players that you can drop into other websites, detailed analytics to see how people are listening, tools to promote your podcasts, and much, much more. But wait, because the more is now. Because if you follow the link in our show notes, when you sign up, it lets Buzzsprout know that we sent you. And do you know what that gets you? $20 worth of credit when you sign up for a paid plan. And that warm feeling in your stomach, knowing that not only are you on your way to podcast greatness, but that you've helped support this show too. So if you're starting your podcast, or you're looking to move your podcast, use Buzzsprout and follow our link in the show notes. Back to the episode. All right, so I guess it's my turn then. I think it is remarkable that this is from 1987. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that so Lucas, I know you find scores difficult or whatever, but obviously this is a season where you're scoring things in a different way. Does that mean this would be even lower in your previous regime of scoring?
Well, it's irrelevant, isn't it? Because my old regime of scoring, I have acknowledged, was flawed. So why does it matter? Cool.
Well, no, that's what I'm interested in, though, is like the 5 out of 10 is with all of this context that we've talked about rolled into it. And the idea that this is 1987 and it still sounds so ahead of its time is interesting to me. I'm wondering if you're rolling that into your score. Because it sounds ahead of its time in a way that other REM albums haven't so far, I think.
You've made a point there now that's made me want to put a little 0.5 on it for a little sweetener, but...
Okay, well, you don't have to, it's fine. It is not my favourite REM record from the 80s, like it is for many, many other people, but then for many other people it was their introduction to the band, so that will hold some kind of sway for them. Of the 5 albums that we've heard so far, it's my 4th favourite. So same as Steve, I think. But I really like it. So it's actually more of a high watermark issue than it is an issue with the record itself. I think it's bold and mm-hmm. it's like robust and it's catchy and it's dark and it mixes their accessibility with their complexities and just kind of compounds everything that they've been working on up to this point into this kind of singular statement on that band and the world around them at that moment. It very much is a document. And it really feels like they didn't do what they did on Reckoning, for instance, and go, these are just the 10 most recent songs we've written, or whatever, you know? There's an attempt to create something coherent and cohesive, even in some of the chaos that is presented on the album. There's a couple of songs that I'm not as keen on, and in general, I don't think they fully, successfully hold that darker tone for the whole of the album, or maybe the darker tone doesn't hold my interest for the whole album. And I find the bits of light that creep in here feel a bit less convincing to me than the hints of darkness that crept through on the much lighter, more hopeful and inspiring Life's Rich Pageant. And Life's Rich Pageant was obviously a 10 for me. So there's a lot to like here, though, I think. Although not my lowlights. Don't really like those. I'm going Lightning Hopkins for the big triple dunk that Lightning Hopkins gets. And
you suck.
Do you know what? Yeah. Sue me. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
Right.
It's going in my lowlights. Everybody, get fucked. And I'm walking away with the big double bird.
We're going to get ratioed on Twitter.
Highlights. Welcome to the Occupation. And the one I love is kind of just, as much as invisible as it is, it's just an undeniable song for me, really. It's a difficult one to score, this one, I think, because the highs are very high and it doesn't sustain it over the whole thing. I'm going to go 7. I'm going to go 7.5. I'm going to go 7.5.
To 10.
At 10. I think anyone would struggle to argue that this isn't like a coherent, well-put-together album, which I think just makes it good. and I really like it, but I think it just falls short of being a great album. And some will disagree with that, but I think that comes down to personal taste. This is not necessarily my favourite flavour of REM. You know what I mean?
What's your favourite flavour?
Automatic for the People. Okay, I won't talk about it. But you've heard Automatic for the People, Steve, and you know the kind of REM that I like. Yeah, the Radiohead REM. Right.
What? Move on.
It doesn't mean what you think it means.
As if I wasn't excited for that album.
It doesn't mean what you think it means, I promise.
No, it means that it goes like... and like... and more stuff like that, right? And bloops and bleeps.
Yeah, what?
Just before the album was released, Peter Buck spoke to a journalist and said this: with virtually every record we turn into the record company, we hear outside opinion that this is the one that's going to break you guys. I think at this late date, it would be really delusional to even think that that's going to happen. Then again, I don't care. So,
I love it, isn't he?
Yeah. Anyway, this is the album that breaks these guys. When the album is released, it gets great reviews. Rolling Stone said it was their best to date. It was in Rolling Stone's 2012 edition of the 500 greatest albums of all time. So, if you wanted to check off your spreadsheets, guys, you can. We've done a few of them now. One reviewer said, where Life's Rich Pageant sounded a bit like a party record, Document is a fiery statement, and its memorable melodies and riffs are made all the more indelible by its righteous anger. Village Voice said the band had moved on from the escapism of their past work and that their discovery of the outside world has sharpened their sense of humour along with everything else. John Perales of the New York Times said, Document is both confident and defiant. If REM is about to move from cult band status to mass popularity, the album decrees that the band will get there on its own terms. And REM were about to move from cult band status to mass popularity. Life's Rich Pageant sold 500,000 copies in 6 months, their best-selling album up to that point. Document takes 5 months to sell 1 million copies, which is huge. And it's hugely important in the story of alternative rock because REM and a few other bands by this point had proven that you can make an alternative to mainstream rock and carve out a niche for yourself in music fan circles and gain quite a big cult-like status, you know what I mean? And REM, with this album, showed that you can make an alternative to mainstream rock, never have a hit single, not play the typical record company games, insist on doing things your own way, and sell 1 million copies of an album on an independent label. The album went to number 10 on the Billboard 200, far and away their highest position yet. It's their first top 20 album, and it stayed in the top 200 for 33 weeks. Also, in all fairness, they were about to break that no-hit single streak, because The One I Love went to number 9 in the US charts. It's their first top 10 single. In fact, it's their first single to chart above 78. Looking back on this success many, many years later, Michael Stipe said this: "We never made giant steps to make ourselves a viable hit-making band for American radio. Radio came to us. Pop culture just swung into our little stubborn trajectory." They'd kind of always done what they wanted to do and waited for people to come around to them to some degree. They had been ahead of their time for so long, and now culture was kind of opening up to the more alternative side of things, and REM were just kind of waiting for them. Or, as Peter Buck put it to Rolling Stone, "We're the acceptable edge of the unacceptable stuff," which I think is a nice way of putting it.
Yeah.
The album in the UK, and I think Lucas mentioned this a little bit earlier, it reached number 28, around where Reckoning and Fables of the Reconstruction landed. So they still weren't really making huge waves in Europe. And of course, they didn't even tour Europe for the last album.
I made a joke and accidentally apparently made a point.
You accidentally hit on a fact.
Yeah. What happened eventually? Monkey Tiger.
A clock. The wrong clock.
You're
twice
like a gremlin. You are like a gremlin. We cannot take you past midnight. We should never do that again. We should never. So anyway, they didn't tour Europe for Life Switch Pageant. And they don't really this time either. They started what they called the Work Tour in September 1987 with a show at the Hammersmith Odeon in London. And then they played a show in the Netherlands, a show in France, and a show in West Germany. And they hadn't played Europe since the Fables tour, and the shows were very markedly different. Stipe had been quite ill in 1985 back then, if you remember, and they were playing those Fable songs, the dark, slow songs, and now Michael Stipe was incredibly outgoing. He was used to playing in arenas, and they were playing these more energetic, hard rock songs. So the shows went down really well, but that was it for Europe, just four shows. And in October, the Work Tour went around North America. And these are, you know, arenas and such, and they tour for 2 months, again ending at the Fox Theatre in Atlanta, but this time for four shows instead of three. Again, they don't repeat set lists across the tour. They're throwing in covers and B-sides and songs that would end up on the next album. They use projections of artistic images and videos or flash up some text. And they had Buren Fowler return, providing additional guitar on a few songs, just like they did for Pageant. Also in October, they released their first ever VHS tape, and it's called Succumbs, and we're going to do an audio commentary for it next week. In December 1987, REM were on the cover of Rolling Stone with the headline, "REM, America's Best Rock and Roll Band." And that is obviously like a huge deal. I mean, Rolling Stone in the 80s was basically the kind of cool end of the mainstream, which I guess then ties in with Buck saying that REM were the acceptable end of the unacceptable. They're just perfectly meeting in the middle there. And then they were famous, basically. That was it. They were just famous then. Being on the front cover of a magazine means absolutely fuck all these days in 2024. But in 1987, it meant people recognised you. Like so many people used to read Rolling Stone. And that's the end of 1987. We've typically wrapped up each episode at the end of each year, but there is something here that I think warrants us extending our reach a little bit on this one. With the release of Document, REM had fulfilled their contract with IRS Records. IRS had, over the years, attempted to renegotiate the contract for more money and a longer term. And most artists who are like eager for some cash, you know, they snap that up. REM declined every time it was offered, and they were just happy to wait it out and see what it was like when the contract was there, and then maybe they'd renegotiate then. Those UK chart positions that we mentioned, this kind of, it bothered the band. Like, why was there so much success in America but not in Europe? And it was kind of because IRS just didn't have the distributing power in Europe. They weren't getting word out. They weren't getting those distribution deals. IRS did have a distributing partner in MCA Records, a major label, but REM felt that they were not considered any kind of priority.
And at the beginning of 1988, REM let the heads of IRS know that they would not be renewing their contract and that they would be leaving the record label. REM's management, which at this point is kind of shared between Jefferson Holt and Burtis Downs, approached all the record companies that had expressed any kind of interest over the years. And there were numerous offers. Some of them, silly money. Like, silly money, apparently. But that wasn't what was important to REM. And there was one record label that was offering two things that no others could. All of them offered better worldwide distribution, more press, a bigger marketing budget, more support, bigger advances, so like more money up front. There was one record label who was offering less money than anybody else. I think some reports put it at about $12 million, all in all.
Oh, rubbish.
But they were offering complete creative control, so total freedom, which, to be fair, IRS had essentially given them. But this other label was also allowing REM to own its own masters. And that is the deal that they took. And it was with Warner Brothers, the huge major label Warner Brothers, for a 5-album deal. And that was, the masters thing was basically unheard of at the time. Loads of bands owned their own publishing, which REM, of course, did since day one. But nobody owned their masters. And REM were just in the correct position and savvy enough to demand it. And it's basically how you avoid someone else owning your music. So what they agreed...
They'd seen what happened with Taylor Swift and they were like, we're not going to get something
exactly,
to that.
Exactly.
Yeah, we can't have that happening.
So what they agreed was that REM owned their masters but would lease them to Warner Brothers for a contracted amount of time. It's very clever. It's exactly how you avoid the Taylor Swift situation. Very forward-thinking, very innovative. IRS even capitulated and said they would match Warner Brothers' money and royalties, but they couldn't match the masters. So REM passed. And of course, that move away from an independent label immediately draws accusations that they've sold out before they've even released any music. They get a little defensive about that initially, but it was on them. They'd have to put all of that money, the $12 million, where their mouth was, because their next album was going to be their major label debut. And so that's where we leave them. And all of that in mind, actually, what are you expecting from the next album?
God, like at this point, I have no idea. I'd like to think that they're probably going to, for the major label, it's going to be accessible, but I genuinely don't know.
Now you've said that about major labelness, that's obviously put an idea in, I'm sure, probably Steve's as well's head, of just like, it's not out of time, is it? There's another one first.
It's Green, no, right?
There's an album called Green that's coming next.
Right, because I don't know, but I have inferred, maybe wrongly, that Out of Time is another leap into the mainstream, another sort of step into that. So I don't know if Green is just another step along the way to that, or if it's a weird one that happens in between, which actually is like a weird dark horse. I don't know. Short answer, Adam, I don't know.
Now, isn't that interesting for a band that you've said all sounds the same?
That we don't know where they're going with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, I know that they're going to sound like Radiohead eventually, so that's really cool, you know?
Yeah. No, I didn't say they sounded like Radiohead. Didn't say that.
You said Radiohead REM or something.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, that album isn't actually going to be covered for a few weeks yet because we're at the end of an era for REM. We're at the end of the IRS years, as they are sometimes called. It's one of three 5-album cycles that the band have. So we're going to take stock, look back on and examine this period of their career as a whole. And we're also going to rank the albums that we've heard so far. We're going to pick out our favourite songs, make our own top 10 lists and build a little best of compilation. So that'll be exciting. We're going to do that in a couple of weeks' time. Just really briefly, I want to dedicate this episode, to Becca Carroll, who is one of our biggest mate subscribers over on the Patreon. Becca Carroll, this episode's yours. Do with it whatever you want. If you want me to type it up into a transcript so that you can set fire to it, I'll do it. That's fine. It doesn't bother me.
Are you all right?
That brings us to the end of another episode. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Our next episode is out next Monday. We're going to have a little watch-along of the REM VHS and Betamax release, Succumbs. Succumb, and join us for that. That's something, isn't it? Before you do, let us know what you think of Document. Come and tell us everything. This show works best when it's in direct conversation with all of you lovely people. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, What Is Music Pod, TikTok at What Is Music, and if you'd like to send something a little bit longer and we can read it out on the show, you can email us, whatismusicpod@gmail.com. If you liked what you heard here and you thought I'd like to hear more of that, please do head over to our Patreon page where you'll find all kinds of extra podcast shows. There's one where we revisit Manic Street Preachers, still not good. One where we explore all kinds of different artists, genre and eros, to make themed playlists, bonus commentaries and music discussion episodes. There's ad-free episodes of this show and there's a really amazing Discord community. Head to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in the show notes for up to 2 podcast episodes every single week of your life. There are also other ways you can support us if you'd like to. You could buy some of our merchandise over at whatismusicpod.redbubble.com or send us a little one-off donation over on ko-fi.com, which is ko-fi.com/whatismusic. Would you be surprised to learn, listeners, that we don't pre-record these and I do them live every single time while the other guys look at me like they want to die? The best way to support us, however, is to do what you're doing right now, which is listening to us. You can rate the show, subscribe to the show, share it with your friends, all of that stuff. That about does it. Thank you again for listening. It really does mean a lot to us. We will see you next week, but for now, it's the end of the episode as we know it, and I feel pretty good.
And I feel sublime.
I feel Document.
Okay, yeah, fair.